I'm Mike Collins. Join Charlotte Talks as we take our local news roundup across the border to South Carolina on Friday, February 28th. We'll broadcast live from Amelie's in Rock Hill. We'll talk about the South Carolina primary and the top Charlotte stories of the week. For information, go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. America has been involved in a war for decades now. We have been fighting on many fronts, but we refer to it as a war on terrorism. Lieutenant General Michael Nagata had a front row seat to that war for 34 of his 38 years in the Army. He worked in special operations and is the former director of strategic operational planning at the National Counterterrorism Center. He spent a lot of time asking the question, are we winning? And we'll ask that question of him right now. Lieutenant General Michael Nagata is here. Thanks to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And General Nagata will be speaking today at noon at the Hilton Charlotte Center City. You can get information about how you can attend on our website at WFAE.org. Well, in America, the military reports to a civilian government, which changes 4 to 8 years, every 4 to 8 years. And it's the commander-in-chief who decides how to use and where to use the military and whether or not to send them into harm's way. We have been at war for 2 decades under 3 presidential administrations. Behind the scenes, is there frustration among the military as we go through these gyrations every 8 years?
That's a fair question. I'm going to try to answer it in two parts. First of all, in any large organization, I don't think it matters whether it's a governmental organization or a civilian or commercial organization, there's always a certain amount of frustration. The leaders have difficulty communicating or persuading their people to believe what they're saying. The workforce has its own problems. They can be financial, they can be structural, they can be organizational problems. So it's a rather glib response initially, but of course, there's always some degree of frustration. But I know that's not the thrust of your question. I think that a reasonably fair summation of the frustration that I have personally witnessed, whether it was in my various assignments in Washington, D.C., working on either policy or strategy, or in my time forward deployed in some of these places you've already alluded to, the frustration is mostly oriented around the tension between a predictable and I think probably unavoidable desire for clarity, not just for the people that are doing the work or the political leaders that are our bosses, but for the American people, clarity about how we're doing and clarity about how this ends versus the fact that the struggle that not just the United States but the entire world is waging against violent extremism of all forms, not just the jihadist or ISIS, al-Qaeda variety, but the enormous spectrum of violent extremists that really crosses any number of social or political constructs defies prediction about how it ends, and it defies clarity because it is so complex and so unpredictable.
Did we know that going in? Because it seems to me, particularly in Afghanistan, Afghanistan has been at war with various different other powers for years, and they never lose. And they never lose because they never stop fighting, no matter what the outcome seems to be. So did we understand the complexity of all this when we started all this?
Yeah, I think the answer is indisputably we did not.
Why not?
Again, I think there are several reasons, but I'll try to be brief about this. One is because the United States is separated by two oceans and is so distant from places like Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Yemen, what have you, it's harder for Americans to understand how complex these environments are. But just as importantly, there has always been a certain amount of presumption. Some might even call it arrogance. I'm not sure I would go that far. But there has long been a presumption in the United States. I think I would think it probably is rooted in our enormous success in World War II, that our power and our sense of we're trying to do the right thing will overcome whatever complexity we are confronting.
Well, I was going to ask about that because America came in and helped win World War I. Had we not gotten into World War II, I think it could be argued that and the Axis powers would be controlling Europe and much of Asia today.
It would be a very different world.
Be a very different world. So having won those two wars, we go into these other conflicts, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, not Iran, but Iraq and Syria.
Right.
And we're not winning like we used to win in World War II, and it's flabbergasting.
Yeah.
How is that possible?
Well, it's possible because I think too many people, both inside and outside of government, made an understandable but ultimately unfortunate mistake that victory over the Axis powers would be very similar to what victory would look like over organizations like Al-Qaeda or ISIS or what have you, without, in my view, sufficient regard for the reality these are very different.
Yeah.
These are almost polar opposite problems. At the risk of using a rather ridiculous analogy, you would never expect a physician to say, I'm going to treat cancer exactly the same way I treat the flu. They're both diseases, but no one would accept the proposition that exactly the same medical approach will be used for both. I think that is somewhat analogous to the approach that America inadvertently assumed would be true.
Kennedy's secretary, I think he was Secretary of Defense, it's a long time ago, I can't remember, McNamara.
Yes.
Prosecuted the Vietnam War and later came out and said he made a mistake.
He did.
That it was his whole approach was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the civilian leaders that we've had since
9/11
will at some point come back and say, we made a mistake. We didn't approach this the right way.
I don't know the specific answer to your question because I think my personal view is it's highly unpredictable whether or not a past political actor slash policymaker will in the future do what you just suggested. But what I hope for is an American leadership recognition, which I think is a more accurate diagnosis, is that our approach to violent extremism around the world and our approach to violent extremism inside the United States is incomplete. There are some, in my humble opinion, some rather magnificent thing the United States can and does do against violent extremism, but it's almost literally only half the loaf, and there's another half the loaf that we're not taking seriously.
And violent extremism today is very different from what you might call the violent extremism of the Nazi regime in the 1930s and 40s in Germany. We have developed the most expensive, most highly technical, most powerful military the world has ever known.
Undoubtedly.
We spend, I think, in 2019, we spent $684.6 billion on the military. The closest country to that was China at $181 billion.
Right.
We spend more on the military than the next nine countries combined.
Right.
I was going to ask you, are we getting our money's worth? But the better question is, are we spending that money appropriately?
Right. Great questions. This answer will probably be dissatisfying, and I'm not trying to fend the question off by answering it with a question, but I'm going to answer it with a question anyways. It depends on what we expected the military to do.
Right.
If our expectation was exclusively that we expected the U.S. military to use physical or kinetic force, which is what the U.S. military does, to save lives that were in imminent danger, to rescue hostages, to disrupt or destroy imminent threats to Americans or American interests, then I think you can make a fair argument that the American people got their money's worth, because we do those things very well. Not perfectly, but certainly better than we've ever done them before. Our ability to illuminate, identify, track, and bring either to a law enforcement or military ends some terrorist leader around the world. Best examples were the raids that killed Osama bin Laden and more recently Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. If that's all we expect the military to do, yes, we're getting our money's worth. But I think that that several administrations have been a little sloppy about aligning their expectations with what they are asking the various arms of the United States government to do. And let me sum this all up so I don't blather on too long about this. This other loaf that I talked about that we're not addressing sufficiently is related to what I've described the military does, but it's something the military is not equipped or trained or capable of doing. And that is prevent people from becoming terrorists.
It also strikes me that militaries, by their very nature, are killing machines. They're designed to have chaos and mass destruction on the enemy. That's how you win. You disorient them, you kill them, and you destroy infrastructure around them so they can't operate. And a lot of what we seem to have to do in the Middle East and in Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that are surgically precise, small, almost police operations. Is the military designed for that?
It is now, by dint of necessity, particularly the community that I hail from, the special operations community. We've had to dramatically refine and improve our ability to do these pinpoint precision operations you're alluding to, because there's been no alternative. The fact that we were having to do this in foreign lands, far from home, in denied areas, where the amount of risk that the force would have to accept in order to go on these targets was just so high that we couldn't legitimately ask anybody else to do it. So in that regard, I would again argue it was an appropriate use of the U.S. military, but what the U.S. military is not equipped to do, it's not trained, organized, or equipped to do, that as every year goes by, I think the need for this grows larger and larger and larger, is for not just the United States government, but for governments everywhere, for societies everywhere, to recognize that we have a growing global problem of violent extremism. And neither the police nor the military are the appropriate tool for persuading people in all societies everywhere not to take the path to violent extremism. In fact, governments, as a general rule, are poorly positioned to do this because there is so much mistrust between large swaths of pretty much every country's population against their own government. So in many cases, the government's voice is not credible.
I want to come back to that, because that's something that's really important for people to understand, and what we're up against and how you fight it. And it's not traditional in any stretch of the imagination.
Correct.
Our guest is General Michael Nagata, U.S. Army retired and former director of the Strategic Operational Planning at the National Counterterrorism Center. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Thanks to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte, we have Lieutenant General Michael Nagata in our midst. He's U.S. Army retired, former director of strategic operational planning at the National Counterterrorism Center. He's speaking at noon today at the Hilton Center City, and you can go to our website for more information. And you're speaking today on the topic of, are we winning? And you say the answer to that, you have to define by saying what winning means.
That is correct.
What does it mean?
Unfortunately, I don't think I can give you a straightforward answer. In my view, particularly in my last 3 years as arguably the senior counterterrorism strategist in the U.S. government, I do not believe there is a consensus. I don't think there's been a consensus since 9/11, frankly, about what we mean when we use the word win. Now, I can articulate, I'll try to be brief about this, three different versions of win that I've heard over the years. All of them have their merits, but the problem is they're all very different. One definition of winning is we're never going to have another 9/11. Mm-hmm. By that definition, I suppose we're winning. The problem is people keep trying to create another 9/11. There are any number of plots we've had to disrupt, and there's literally no end to this if we
I know you can't talk about a lot of this, but have they been on the scale of what happened on 9/11?
We'll never know. Okay. We'll never know because we were able to identify them and disrupt them before we could characterize how large an attack it might have been. Whether they're small or large attacks, frankly, they almost all have the same political impact and societal impact. I mean, just look at what's been happening in Europe with small knife attacks and automobile attacks. The political chaos that it's created in Europe is all out of proportion of the amount of mortality that's been created. Every death is a tragedy, of course. Right. But it's a definition. We're never going to have a 9/11, but we're the enormous amount of treasure we're having to sink in preventing another 9/11 perpetually begs the question, isn't there a better definition? Right. So here's another one. Another one is the United States is going to become much better than it's ever been at identifying, at tracking, and then bringing either to a law enforcement or military outcome some bad terrorist actor somewhere in the world. By that definition, we're winning as well because the amount of improvement the entire United States government has made, not just the military, but particularly in the intelligence community, in doing what I just said, identifying, tracking, and then bringing to an effective end, whether it's going to prison or going to their grave, a terrorist actor somewhere in the world. We're so much better. We're exponentially better than we've ever been. But again, it suffers from the same problem the first definition does. There's no end to this. We have to keep doing it. In fact, there's a rather sarcastic saying in the CT community these days where we talk about this is mowing the grass.
CT is counterterrorism.
Right.
Okay.
It's mowing the grass. It'll look good for a while because we just mowed it. But eventually the grass will grow back, and we'll have to do it again. So it's a deeply unsatisfying definition of winning because, again, there's no end to this. Finally, there is the definition that I am the most personally attracted to and I think is closest to being right. The problem is this is the one we're the least serious about, both as a government, as a society, and frankly as an international community. Learning how to prevent people from becoming terrorists, that is not completely unexplored territory. There are organizations, agencies, and even non-governmental actors that are striving in this arena. But compared to the investments that are made in these other two formulas I've described, the amount of effort being made in preventing people from becoming terrorists is trivial.
That's what you were talking about before the break, that neither police nor military have been very good at persuading people not to take the radical path.
That's right.
Why haven't we been able to do that? We seem to be doing. Why haven't we?
Yeah. There are so many reasons. I'm only hesitating because I want to be brief about my answer. The first one may sound a little glib, but I'm actually serious about this. Particularly in the developed world, I think it has something to do with the fact that I'll use myself as an example. You know, growing up. You know, I'm marinated in an idea that I now know is wrong, but every action movie and every action TV show I've ever seen in my life, every action novel I've ever read always has the same ending. And it's the happy ending when the worst of the bad people is arrested, imprisoned, done away with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the movie, that's when the music plays and, you know, the heroine and the hero link up and they ride off into the sunset. That's fantasy. But I think in a almost subconscious way, it's led us to believe, well, that's how we win the war against terrorism, just by doing away with these people that are taking up arms today, and then everything will be, you know, puppies and unicorns after that. It's proven to be demonstrably wrong. It is necessary to remove these people, particularly if they're about to kill somebody, but it's not the answer. So that's one reason. Another reason is because it's just not fashionable for governments, and particularly our government, to invest in what I call non-kinetic capabilities of the United States government or capabilities in our society. It means persuading people without the use of physical force not to take the path to radical or extremist violence. That is best done, frankly, by civil society actors. It's best done by non-governmental organizations. It's best done by local educators, community leaders, religious leaders. But they require resources, they require training, they require education, they require information. All that requires policy support, all that requires money, but it is not very fashionable, neither for our government nor really for any government that I'm aware of, to invest the kind of resources or consistent political support to these civilian actors that large militaries like the one I hail from constantly enjoy.
But why not? It would seem to be that would be the less expensive approach, even if I'm not sure it's possible.
It would be.
Because these people who are radicalizing either because they are zealots and they hold some ideology that we cannot penetrate, or they are extremely frustrated about conditions that governments could change.
Very true. Very true. There are so many reasons. Again, there's so many answers to your question, why not? Why don't we do these things? But I think one of the most important ones is it's hard to describe, it's almost impossible to describe today how making these alternative investments lead to the success that has long eluded us. It's not sexy. It's not dramatic. You know, it's easy. You know, hearkening back to the previous administration, it's very easy and very attractive for political leaders of all stripes to get up in front of a microphone and talk about an awesome night it was the day we killed Osama bin Laden, because it's a describable, specific, dramatic moment. It is far less attractive to get to the microphone and have to explain, look, we're going to invest in civilian programs and indirect support to educators so they don't have the taint of being aligned with Big Brother, so that over years, over generations, we will gradually reduce the attractiveness of violent extremism among our population. That is a much harder narrative to sell.
But when you have these dramatic moments like the killing of Osama bin Laden, which is very satisfying for Americans, doesn't that actually cause more radicalization, more extremism on some people's parts.
I'm unsure about that. There are people who make that argument. I'm unaware of a lot of empirical data that proves what you just said. It's not illogical. I'm always cautious about agreeing with anything I haven't seen substantial evidence for. But one thing is for sure. Here's what we have learned. I as you might imagine, both in my past job as well as even today, I get occasionally called by journalists asking – I'll use the recent killing of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. I got asked by several journalists, what did I think would happen as a result of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi? Mm-hmm. And I said exactly the same thing that happened after we killed Osama bin Laden. The positive effects we gain from the death of this senior leader will be very high the day we killed him, and will attenuate every day thereafter until the point we will get to where we will have to reconcile ourselves to the fact that the effect of the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi or Osama bin Laden today is negligible.
But that is not to say that we shouldn't do it.
That not to say we shouldn't have done it. It did important but temporary damage to those two terrorist organizations.
And when you talk about people becoming radicalized and our inability to persuade them not to become radicalized, you're talking about not just people in other countries. You're talking about here.
Yes. There is, in my view, and I stated this publicly on the record while I was at the National Counterterrorism Center, over the last generation, we've seen a growth in domestic violent extremism of all forms, both jihadist-inspired as well as racial supremacist, ecological extremist, you name it. There's a wide array of these non-jihadist extremist groups. We've seen a growth in both of these arenas that has been substantial and continuous. We have more violent extremists inside the United States today than we've probably had at any time in our history.
I have two questions about that. Why is the most important question, right. But also, is it true that we have more today, or are they simply, do they simply feel that they have been given permission to crawl out of the woodwork?
I think it's I think it's factually demonstrable there are more today.
Okay.
I think a reasonable indicator of this is an examination of how many federal investigations the FBI is having to conduct every single day on cases where we believe, or the FBI believes, that there is a serious threat emerging. These cases are in the thousands today. We've never been here before.
So why? Why is it happening now?
Why is it happening? This may be a rather astonishing answer to you, but I have come to the conclusion after studying this question for much of my career, but particularly intensively when for the last 3 years, again, arguably, I was the senior CT strategist in the government. We don't know.
Wow.
We do not know. There are many theories, but and I'm sure for your listening audience, this is probably an astonishing answer that some probably don't think is very credible. But I base my answer on my own search for empirical research that explains why people take the path to violent extremism.
Mm-hmm.
And I have come to the conclusion after years of examining this that if, for example, one compares the volume of empirical research that exists in, say, the causes of the flu or the causes of cancer, and then you compare it to the amount of empirical research that exists today that attempts to answer the question, why do people become terrorists? It is it's like comparing the size of the sun to the size of the moon.
So given the amount of money that we spend on the military-industrial complex, should we be spending more money in that area to figure this answer out? Why? It does not fill me with confidence that we don't know why this is happening.
Yeah, and my answer is yes, but it's not
I'm not suggesting
we should shift the Department of Defense's budget to research, but the amount of empirical research is so wafer thin about this very complex question about why people take the road to terrorism that even a modest addition of additional resources for empirical research on this question would be a revolution.
Well, are there other people in the government who feel this way?
Are there
people in the government encouraging leaders to spend more money in this area, do more research?
And
is it falling on – are people listening?
Gradually, slowly.
And who are those people that need to listen?
Oh, there are people in any particular presidential administration that happens to be in office, and there are people in Congress. I would argue this conversation should be happening with state governments because this is as much a state problem as it is a federal problem.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be a more robust conversation among and between civil society actors of all forms in anticipation of additional policy or resource support from either federal or local governments, how should it be used? Because, I mean, I'm sure you know within any walk of life, without a plan, the likelihood that new money will be used wisely is very low. But unfortunately, the density and the sophistication of the conversations that I believe are necessary to take advantage of growing interest that I see in the government that, hey, killing and arresting people isn't solving the problem. They may be necessary, but not solving the problem. We have to start looking in other fields for the rest of the answer. So there is gradually growing interest in what I'm, again, will style as non-kinetic, non-use of force approaches to violent extremism, but it's gradual.
So this is not military, and you're a military guy, and you're concerned about this. What is it? Is it intelligence? Is it psychological? What is this? Who fixes this? Who should be in charge of this?
I don't know yet. I'm convinced that it probably has to be civilian-led.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably has to involve civilian, non-military, non-law enforcement organizations to the maximum extent possible. I'm not suggesting the military or particularly law enforcement has absolutely no place in this. Certainly local law enforcement should be a significant component of this because they know their own communities better than anybody else does in the law enforcement world. But we should be very careful about having government hands on this program because there's so much mistrust at local levels of government action.
But after 9/11, particularly the New York City Police Department got highly involved in this, and they began cooperating with our intelligence agencies and with the FBI, and they have quelled anything from happening. It's difficult to prove a negative, but nothing has happened.
No, they absolutely have. The NYPD has been magnificent.
Should local police departments be focusing, I mean, be patterning their approach to this that way?
No. In my view, no. There are certainly things NYPD that does in the arena of identifying, tracking, and arresting potentially violent offenders that I think all law enforcement organizations should learn from. But NYPD has the same problem small law enforcement organizations do. They are not trained, organized, and equipped to help their communities never become criminals.
Right.
Never become terrorists for this particular conversation. That's not their mandate. That's not their focus. That's not why they get money. But it is a shift that if we do not take, we'll continually admire our ability to arrest and kill people, but we'll never solve the problem.
I have about 35 seconds left. President Trump has called senior military commanders a bunch of dopes and babies, claiming, "I wouldn't go to war with you people."
Mm-hmm.
He's taken issue with intelligence reports, and all these things you're talking about are probably things he doesn't want to hear. I don't know that. But instead of embracing things as facts that come to him from military and from intelligence quarters, as previous presidents did, he finds a way to take issue with them or diminish them or cast suspicions on the people who are bringing that information to him. Can we successfully prosecute a war on terrorism and do all the things we've talked about in that environment? And I have 20 seconds.
We can. I think we should. I mean, as unfortunate as some of these reported remarks by the current president may be, what matters far more is what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And this president did approve a national counterterrorism strategy that I helped author to do what I've been talking about.
Lieutenant General Michael Nagata, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. It's WFAE Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.